Millions of people around the world are outraged over the death of Cecil the Lion. But this is not an isolated case. This hour, the high-stakes, high-dollar world of trophy hunting. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Megan Brown is a graduate student in the MFA program at Iowa State University. She writes about the relationships between humans and animals and has just published a piece about trophy hunting in Salon.com. I'll talk with her. Then later in the hour, Garrison Keillor, longtime host of A Prairie Home Companion, has announced his retirement. I'll talk with him about his plans for his last season of the show and life after retirement. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Garrison Keillor is coming to Iowa this month on his America the Beautiful tour. When that tour was announced, we did not know that it would be a farewell tour. This season of A Prairie Home Companion will be his last. I'll talk with him about retirement, his future, and the future of the show later this hour. But first, when word got out that a trophy-hunting dentist from Minnesota killed Cecil the Lion, a beloved lion in Zimbabwe involved in a long-term research study conducted by Oxford University, outrage spread very quickly. But this is not an isolated incident. Megan Brown is a graduate student in the MFA program at Iowa State University. She studies and writes about the relationships between humans and animals, and she's done a great deal of research in an effort to understand the world of trophy hunting. She just published a piece about trophy hunting in Salon.com, and she is with us today. Hello, Megan.
Hello, Charity. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for coming today. And what drew you to researching this area in the first place? What interested you about the world of trophy hunting?
Well, it's actually part of my work with animal subcultures in general. That includes trophy hunters. It also includes furry fans. It includes people who show horses competitively. Basically, any subculture that revolves around animals. And trophy hunting, obviously, is a big one. So that's part of my upcoming book that I'm going to be seeking a publisher for. The way I got interested in animal subcultures in general was as I was growing up, you know, animals were friends and family members. And then I started to realize that people around the world saw them a lot differently than I did. And I was really curious what makes one person look at a lion one way and love that lion and want to save him. And then what makes somebody else want to pay several thousand dollars to kill him. So I think that that's fascinating.
Absolutely. And in researching the world of trophy hunting, I mean, this is a fairly elite and somewhat secretive world. People are paying thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, in some cases even millions of dollars, to hunt what they consider to be very desirable game. It's not something that they really want a lot of publicity for. How have you gone about researching this world?
Well, you're right. That's actually one of the biggest challenges for me to research trophy hunters. I've reached out to a number of trophy hunters and hunting outfitters, and I have yet to have one who's willing to allow me to accompany them as a journalist on a hunt. So what I've done to kind of get around that is I've watched videos and films that are put out for trophy hunters by other trophy hunters. I've studied the websites that outfitters use to market these hunts and the language that they use and what buttons they push. And then another big component of my research is what I call intra-group communication, which is communication involving members of a group to one another. So it's not really meant for public consumption, and then it hasn't been sort of varnished or whitewashed. It's sort of one person who's already in that subculture talking to another person, and you can get a really good idea of, get inside their heads just by being a fly on the wall and listening to what they say to one another.
Well, as I mentioned, I mean, this Walter Palmer killing this lion, this was not an isolated incident in any way, shape, or form. Can you give me an idea? And let's focus on lions right now. How does this work if there's a wealthy hunter in the United States or somewhere else in the world who wants to travel to Africa to kill a lion. What is the process? How does that work?
Well, it sort of depends on what type of experience that hunter wants. There are some outfitters that offer hunts for wild lions that have never really had any contact with people, and there's arguably an element of fair chase hunting to that. But another big way that people go hunting for lions these days is captive bred lions, what would be known in some circles as a canned shoot or a canned hunt. So there are actually game farms in Africa that specialize in breeding lions, and what they do is they get them old enough to hunt, and they let them out into sort of a fenced area, and the animal basically wanders around until it gets shot. And obviously there are even trophy hunters that have gone on the record to say that that is reprehensible. So that's obviously a big area of controversy.
Well, for the people who act as guides for these hunters, I mean, this is a tremendous economic opportunity, pretty clearly.
It is. Palmer reportedly paid skywards of $50,000 for the opportunity to kill a lion.
And I can imagine for the people who take that money, there's a lot of pressure to deliver for a wealthy client. Say, you know, somebody's flying in and they're going to be there for a week. The pressure to make sure that there is something there for them to kill, I can imagine, would lead to a lot of situations similar to the one with Cecil.
You're absolutely right. And that is a big catch-22 with trophy hunting. Hunters really, by and large, they don't want to feel that their experience is fake. That's something that a lot of people don't realize, is that hunters really don't want to feel that their experience is what we might consider a canned shoot. But at the same time, if they're paying $50,000 or more to get that trophy, there's a lot of pressure on these outfitters to deliver the goods. And Palmer gave a statement in which he said he wasn't aware that this was an illegal hunt. He was relying on the expertise of his guides. And a lot of people have said, you know, well, that's, I really don't believe him. I think that he's lying about that. I actually think that that might be, you know, I think he might be shooting straight with us there. I think he might have relied on his guides, and his guides were under a lot of pressure. And so they acted illegally to make sure that he got the trophy he paid for.
And let's talk about the legality of these hunts, because it is legal practice in much of Africa, right?
It is. And it is. It's currently legal to import lion trophies, although a number of airlines, for example, have now decided that they're not going to carry these trophies, just as a they're taking a moral stand against it. So it's legal to import them, and it's legal to conduct these hunts in Africa currently.
Well, and there is a movement also to try to get the African lion listed as an endangered species.
Yes, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is currently considering that. And whether or not lion trophies would then be banned for import is not yet decided.
And because we know so much about Walter Palmer, and so much has come out in the recent days after this hunt became public, can you tell me a little bit about him, the number of hunts that he has gone on over the years? Because I think it is symbolic of how many wealthy clients who participate in this collect trophies.
Right. This is a big it's a big collecting behavior. They're really interested in growing a collection and obtaining certain species. And many trophy hunters even keep lists of animals that they plan to kill. Walter Palmer had reportedly 43 kills listed with the Safari Club International, which is a record keeping organization. And those include at least one other lion, buffalo, polar bear, and mountain lion.
And each of those kills also represents an incredible financial investment on his part.
Probably several $1,000s per animal, I would guess.
Is that, do you feel like that's typical of people who get involved in this practice?
They tend to be very wealthy just out of necessity. These hunts cost, you know, some of the cheapest trophy hunts in Africa that I found were still, the trophy fee was $2,500, $3,000. And it just goes upwards from there. They can pay several hundred thousand dollars to kill a certain animal.
Right. And of course, that's on top of the travel and the lodging and the equipment, which can, I'm sure, cost many, many, many thousands of dollars as well.
And then taxidermy costs a couple thousand dollars if you want to have the animal mounted, which almost all of them do.
And this has turned into, I mentioned the economic windfall for people who can act as guides. This has turned into big business in a number of different iterations. You talked about the preserves where they will raise lions and keep them basically in captivity and then allow people to come and shoot them. There are actually places that you've written about where they breed sort of oddball animals because they are even more desirable.
Right. So trophy hunting originated as a way for humans to demonstrate power over animals. It was a way to show that we could, that these animals were no longer to be feared, that we could take them and we could demonstrate our strength and superiority. Well, with the advent of high-powered modern weapons, we can kill just about anything that comes our way. And so the trophy hunter's focus has shifted from a dangerous animal and onto a rare animal. And as a result, there's a small but pretty booming market for unusually colored animals. So one example would be, instead of the regular tawny colored lions, there are breeders in Africa that are breeding white lions specifically for trophy hunting. Another example is the wildebeest. So typically a wildebeest is kind of a slate gray color. Breeders are now breeding wildebeest that are they're the so-called golden wildebeest. They're a light brown color, and they're very striking. They're beautiful animals, but they're being bred primarily as trophies. And a golden wildebeest hunt costs about 100 times the amount that you might pay for a regular wildebeest.
And, of course, not everyone can go on a safari in Africa to hunt. There are also organizations that import these animals into the United States and give hunters the opportunity to kill them.
Right. They import them, or more often they breed them. So there are a number of ranches across the United States that breed exotic animals. They typically are captive bred on site, or there's some domestic trade in them. They also purchase them from exotic animal markets, and they sometimes get them from zoos, especially smaller zoos or roadside zoos that are not the big accredited zoos that we typically think of. And a big part of that industry is actually involving white-tailed deer. The white-tailed deer breeding industry in the United States is about a $1 billion industry. Not all of that is trophy hunting, but a big part of it is.
Well, we'll talk more about that after a break. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a moment. I'm talking with Megan Brown. She's a graduate student in the MFA program at Iowa State University, and she studies and writes about the relationships between humans and animals. And she's done a great deal of research into understanding trophy hunting. She just published a piece in Salon.com called It's Worse Than Walter Palmer and Cecil the Lion, Inside the Sick, Bizarre World of Trophy Hunting. We've put up a link to that article on our Facebook page if you'd like more information, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll be talking with Garrison Keeler, the very longtime host of A Prairie Home Companion. He has announced that he is retiring after this coming season of A Prairie Home Companion. So we'll talk about his retirement, his life after retirement, and the future of the show, which will go on. That's coming up in a few minutes. Right now, I'm talking with Megan Brown. She's a graduate student in the MFA program at Iowa State University, and she studies and writes about the relationships between humans and animals. She's done a great deal of research into the trophy hunting industry. And of course, the trophy hunting industry has been in the spotlight ever since news broke of a trophy hunting dentist from Minnesota who killed beloved Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe. And Megan, just before the break, you brought up white-tailed deer. We had moved into talking about trophy hunting in the United States, which also is a real industry in the United States as well. And you mentioned white-tailed deer. And of course, there are many, many people who hunt white-tailed deer in the more traditional way where they go out and find them themselves. But tell me a little bit about the trophy hunting industry when it comes to white-tailed deer in the U.S.
Well, like I said before the break, it's about a $1 billion industry in the United States. Not all of that money goes for hunting specifically. Some of it goes for they sell the antlers, which are valuable in Eastern medicine. They'll sell urine also as hunting lures. So the lures that you see in the hunting stores, that's where this comes from. But the trophy hunting of white-tailed deer has gotten to be really big just in the past several decades. And what you have is people who want a big trophy deer, but they don't have time to go out and put in. I mean, that's like a once-in-a-lifetime type of animal. And you're talking about somebody who wants it right now. And so there's a market that's sprung up to satisfy that demand. Now, the interesting thing about it is in order to get these trophy deer, obviously in the wild, these are exceptional animals. But when you have to provide them basically at the drop of a hat to a client, these ranches will use special breeding techniques. They'll breed deer with really big antlers and big antler genetics, and they'll feed them special feeds, and they'll make sure that their antlers grow sometimes up to twice the size of a world record wild deer. And the antlers can grow so big that the deer have a hard time holding their heads up. It's pretty amazing.
And then what would someone pay to get an opportunity to shoot a deer like that?
$20,000, $30,000, $40,000 or more.
Now, of course, I can imagine there are many people who are hunters listening to this conversation and thinking, but this has nothing to do with hunting in a sustainable, responsible way. There must be a real split in the hunting community between people who are interested in this kind of thing and people who really condemn it.
Right. There's a huge split, and it's really, to call it a split maybe isn't even the right word, because the majority of everyday Iowa deer hunters that I've spoken to really condemn this. They would be embarrassed to take a trophy like this. They really value the hours and the skill that it takes to obtain a wild, once-in-a-lifetime trophy animal. So they have a few points of contention. First of all, these farms are associated with the spread of chronic wasting disease, which is a tremendous threat to wild deer populations, and it's spreading nationwide. The second is that when somebody can just plop down $30,000 and take one of these trophies, it really, hunters feel that it devalues their trophy animal that they felt that they acquired through more honest means. And the third contention is that it really violates the ethic of fair chase in the eyes of many hunters. So I would say that some of the strongest opposition in terms of online comments and in terms of people that I've spoken to has perhaps surprising to people who are not hunters, but hunters are very much against this. They tend to be, in my experience.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the psychology of trophy hunting, because that's something you've tried hard to understand. What, from your research, what drives someone to spend this kind of money, to have this kind of experience, to have that trophy on their wall?
Well, a common misconception that I've run into from, especially I've heard this online and hundreds of comments of people responding to this news about Cecil, is that these hunters are evil and they're driven by a desire to destroy animals and they hate animals. And really what I found is that trophy hunters, I mean, you don't learn as much as they do about animals, and they don't speak about them with such like awe and reverence if you hate them. So trophy hunters like animals, they're drawn to them, obviously. I think a big driver is everyday shopping and collecting behaviors. It's just on a different scale. One of the things that happens when you become very wealthy is most of the objects you desire are within reach. And when you can just go out and buy anything you want, it's no longer possible to long for something because you can just go right out and have it. So that pleasure of anticipating it is gone. So I think that's a big reason why some wealthy people are drawn to trophy hunting, because once an item is rare, it has to be sort of sought out or won out. You can't just drop by the store and get it. And I think another shopping behavior that has been called acquisitive buying is a big part of it, too. So this is why acquisitive buying is the tendency to collect very similar items, but believing that they're different. It's why some people have 20, 30, 40 pairs of shoes. I think this is the reason why some people don't just want one spiral-horned African antelope on their wall. They want every species. And there are many trophy hunters, you know, that I've encountered that are really after a certain collection of animals. And once they get one, they're just sort of thinking about the next one and the next one and the next one after that.
So, and there are, you talked about earlier trophy hunting hunters keeping lists of animals that they would like to kill. In the communities, in the online communities that you have spent time looking at, there are sort of these pre-made lists, like the Big Five or other kinds of lists that become goals and aspirations.
Right. So the Big Five is one. In the United States, we have what's called the Grand Slam of North American Sheep. So those are a couple different varieties of bighorn and dall sheep and stone sheep. So yeah, the collecting is a big part of trophy hunting. You don't really just stop at one. Trophy hunters, they may not publish lists specifically of animals they want to kill, but you definitely get a sense that each one is sort of keeping a goal, a list of goals personally, and they may allude to it in their communication with one another. So it's clear that collecting is a big driver. I think if trophy hunters had no way of preserving their animal kills through taxidermy, I think that you would probably not see as much trophy hunting behavior simply because you can't preserve those animals.
Now, I think that a lot of people would have a very hard time understanding some of the language that these trophy hunters will use to talk about the animals that they are going to kill. You write about them, you know, knowing every fact that they can possibly know about this animal and really speaking with love and reverence.
Right. That's something that's very counterintuitive. And I've had many conversations with people who just can't wrap their heads around it, that loving and killing can be one and the same. I admit that I can't quite wrap my head around this, but I've sort of gotten to the place where I can understand that this is somebody else's worldview. Somehow those two very different ideas occupy the same territory in their mind. I think that this might be an example of what biologist E.O. Wilson described as biophilia, which is he said it's an innate desire to affiliate and be near the natural world and animals. And I think that trophy hunting might be, at least in some people's eyes, a dysfunctional way of expressing that love and adoration. So trophy hunting is really about wanting to be near animals and be so near them as that they're on their wall.
We're talking about the big business of trophy hunting this hour. My guest is Megan Brown. She's a graduate student in the MFA program at Iowa State University, and she studies and writes about the relationships between humans and animals. We have this comment from David on Facebook. He says, "I grew up hunting and was always told to eat what you kill and only kill to eat. Trophy hunting is simply sick." And, you know, there are a lot of hunters who not only hunt for meat to feed their families or to feed themselves and eat what they kill, but also who have a sort of a conservation ethic. And in hunting the biggest and the strongest and the animal with the biggest rack, that really goes against the conservation ethic in many ways. So there are further splits within the hunting realm as well.
Right. One of the points that I make in my book that's just wrapping up here is that hunting sort of operates along a continuum between process-oriented and product-oriented. So the people that really value the time they put in the woods and the skills that they learn to acquire that deer, and a lot of them, you know, they might be people who would like to get a deer at the end of the day, but they don't really care. Something that I see often, the saying is, a bad day in the woods beats a good day in the office. So on the one end, you have you have hunters like David who are really concerned about the skill and the knowledge and the time that they put in nature, and whether or not they kill an animal is very secondary to that. On the other spectrum, on the end of the spectrum, are people who pay $50,000 to shoot basically a captive animal. So, and you can have hunters that are anywhere in between.
Now, of course, a lot of those hunters who engage in trophy hunting would say that they're investing this money and it actually benefits conservation. Is there a kernel of truth to that argument?
Yes, there is, actually. And really, this is where it gets kind of sticky. So, for example, Kenya banned trophy hunting, I believe it was in 1970, and their wildlife populations dropped dramatically after that happened. And what nobody saw coming was that these big game preserves no longer had economic viability, so they began to get sectioned off. There was farming brought in, and instead of kudu and wildebeest and lion, you had cattle and sheep and animals obviously that aren't native there. So these ecosystems were getting destroyed and have yet to rebound. So the big thing to keep in mind is that intact ecosystem has to have more value as an intact ecosystem than it would have for any other purpose in order for that place to survive. Money, unfortunately, talks, and we're going to destroy and change landscapes that we can't make money off of. That's just, it's an awful, but it's a sad fact of just having 7 billion or more people on this planet. The other argument would be that ecotourism and people who come to see these animals alive brings in a lot more money than trophy hunting. So if trophy hunting threatens those animals, that ecotourism industry will decline and may not come back. So the literature is very, very mixed, and this is why I don't take a position on this, because it's really not been well studied yet, and even conservation groups disagree vehemently with one another about the impact and the benefit of trophy hunting.
We have a question from Don via Twitter. He says, does the desire to catch the different marlin species compare to the mindset of trophy hunting?
Well, I'm not as familiar with trophy fishing. That's actually something that I'm still researching and would like to add it to my knowledge base. But from what it sounds like, people really do value the diversity of their collection and catching different species of marlin to say that, oh, I've caught them all, or I've got this many different species. That really does sound like what I talked about earlier with acquisitive buying behavior.
David is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, David.
Good morning. As I listen to you talk, I'm impressed by the fact that you're trying to speak rather respectfully about these hunters and even-handedly about why they would do what they do. But when you started talking about the admiration and the love they have for these animals, I began to think that, you know, there are dog owners who love their dogs and keep them in good health and build them up to maximum physical condition, and then they put them in a pit to fight with other dogs. I think those people love their dogs, too. They just see their job in life is to tear up another dog and be torn up themselves. Likewise with cockfighting or, you know, any sport where you're putting animals face-to-face against each other. I think we should call this trophy hunting what it is, and it's just simply an exploitive behavior that has no use in a civilized society.
David, thanks for your call. And Megan, do you think it's a very similar mindset? We have heard in the media, we've heard, you know, back with the Michael Vick scandal, we heard a man talking about how much he loved dogs, but he was running a dog fighting ring.
Right. I think, David, that is an astute and he's just right on point. Dog fighters are another subculture that I've studied, and the comparison that he draws between them are absolutely accurate. I studied dog fighting publications going back several decades, again, trying to get a sense of their what makes them tick, and that's absolutely right. They admire their dogs. They really project onto them these ideas of strength and fortitude and they don't seem to see the brutality of dogs fighting and killing one another for 2 or 3 hours. And I think that when some trophy hunters kill an animal, and especially in the way that Cecil was killed, you know, he was shot with an arrow and he took 40 hours to die, that they don't see that brutality. And that's where I think trophy hunting is hard for regular or non-trophy hunters to understand, is that we really see that brutality, and trophy hunters seem to kind of see past it, or they downplay it.
Now, there's another interesting psychological phenomenon that is involved here as well, and that's the incredible outrage. I mean, people are very, very angry about Cecil being hunted and killed. People who wouldn't be angry about another hunting situation have gotten really, really upset and angry, and there have even been violent threats against the man who killed him. We don't really have time to get into that, but that's an interesting phenomenon as well.
It is, and I think it's just a perfect storm of the way that Cecil died, the fact that he was killed illegally, and sort of the way that Palmer has conducted himself before killing Cecil. He had a run-in with the law and had some other issues as well. So I think it's a perfect storm to create the outrage.
Well, Megan, thank you so much for talking with me today, and I hope we have an opportunity to talk when your book comes out as well.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Megan Brown is a graduate student in the MFA program at Iowa State University. We've put up a link to her article that was published in Salon.com on our Facebook page, so you can check it out there. Coming up in just a moment, my conversation with Garrison Keillor. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.